The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell from Zipify Apps. And I love OneClick Upsell because it offers an incredible amount of bang for the buck. If you get the app, it's simple enough and powerful enough that you can get it set up and get running in an hour or two, get those upsells in front of your customers. And in return, one in six of your customers are going to spend more with you because one in six people who are offered an upsell through OneClick Upsell actually take it. And that's money that just flows instantly without having to spend more on advertising, without having to go through painful, expensive, timely CRO processes. This is something you can set up and start seeing the fruits of right away. They've helped generate over $150 million in additional revenue for Shopify merchants just like you. So if that sounds interesting, you can learn more about OneClick Upsell and get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is sponsored by Klaviyo, the leading e-commerce marketing solution for email and SMS trusted by over 50,000 merchants. Why? Because they have a pretty amazing segmentation and customization engine built in to their marketing platform. It lets you send messages based on what your customers have done, what pages they've visited, how much they've spent with you, how much they're likely to spend with you over time with their very cool LTV prediction tool, what products they've purchased or haven't purchased. It's pretty incredible. And in a world where email inboxes are only getting more crowded, people are getting more ruthless, sending highly targeted messages is the only way you're going to be able to cut through the noise. And you can do that with Klaviyo. So if you want to make more money from your flows, from your efforts on email and SMS, check them out. You can start for free at klaviyo.com/ECF. That's klaviyo.com/ECF. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, a show dedicated to helping seven-figure plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, I'm joined by Nikhil Krishnan to talk about the unmitigated disaster that is healthcare in the United States. Apologies if you're outside the US, may not be super relevant, but if you're inside the United States, this is kind of a big deal because there's probably a wildly inordinate amount of your income or your business's income that is going to play for healthcare. And Nikhil is bringing a really fun, cheeky perspective on healthcare at outofpocket.health. That's his newsletter and website where he talks about and brings brevity to what's usually a pretty boring, if not painful, topic for a lot of us. So he knows a ton about the industry and was lucky enough to have him on. We talk about a ton of stuff. We talk about what's the state of healthcare right now in the United States, you know, in 2021, are premiums coming down a little bit? Actually, why you might actually potentially get a refund this year from your insurance company, which just sounds just insane, but what's going into that? We talk about specifically for small businesses, what are your options? What are your best options if you have a team and you're trying to insure them? We talk about PEOs, professional employer organizations, insurance brokers, shop plans, catastrophic insurance. We talk about health sharing groups, direct primary care, all sorts of really fun acronyms. So we get into the weeds, but we have a good time doing it. I can't imagine anyone else being able to have this lighthearted and fun of a conversation about healthcare. So I was really, really glad he was able to come on. So let's go ahead and jump right into it and kind of getting up to speed on what's going on in the US with healthcare right now. Nikhil, good to have you on the podcast. And I figure I got to start with, if you could, in a single word, describe what it was like growing up with both parents as doctors. So what was that experience like?
So my answer to this is it was safe. I feel like I've avoided, I feel like when you have two parents as doctors, they're like the most risk averse sort of people ever. And then also simultaneously, I think I've avoided many medical bills unnecessarily thanks to their guidance. You know, anecdotally, I've found that people with doctors as parents tend to tell them not to go into medicine, which is maybe maybe signifies what the field is like, but my parents were definitely like that too.
I've heard, I don't have parents that are doctors, but reading some studies and stuff, is it true that kind of just general satisfaction in the profession has kind of gone downhill quite a bit the last 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a combination of just a lot more people working for extremely large companies, a lot more documentation burden put on them. So they're spending less time with patients and more time kind of doing semi-menial work. Just general, I think, sad. And, you know, wages and all that kind of stuff have sort of stagnated even across a lot of parts within healthcare. So I think, yeah, for sure, I think satisfaction has gone down across the board.
So we're going to eventually get into, you know, all the different ways small businesses, e-commerce stores, even individuals should be thinking about buying health insurance today. But let's start at the top. why is healthcare in the United States such a like just an unmitigated disaster? I think obviously super complex. We were joking, you're kind of getting into the e-commerce game as well. We were comparing it to sales tax, although even worse than sales tax, which for anyone listening who knows how what a cluster that is, that's saying something. Very complex space. If you could, you know this space very well. If you could wave a magic wand and have two things change, i.e. the two biggest things that are making it expensive, difficult to access, all the problems, what are the two biggest problems in our system today, you think, in the US?
Yeah. So, I mean, the two structural ones that I think are really bad and sort of uniquely a US problem is one, employers choose your health insurance for you. That is a uniquely US problem. It is an accident from a tax law that was passed post-World War II. But basically, employers get these great tax benefits for choosing your health insurance plan for you. And that really distorts the market because what happens is then health insurance providers are optimizing to get as much money from you as a consumer for the duration at which you're with your employer rather than actually care about your long-term health outcomes. Because if you switch jobs, you'll automatically switch health insurance providers. And so that creates a ton of market distortion and also gives employers this like crazy chokehold on health benefits to kind of keep talent, giving way more power to large companies, et cetera. So one is sort of decoupling health insurance and employment, I think is a huge one. And then the second is our antitrust laws are just really not well equipped to handle healthcare just generally, largely because a lot of the transactions happen below a threshold limit that would normally get reviewed by some sort of antitrust body. There are actually, you know, there are a lot of parts of healthcare that are just exempt from antitrust, like health insurance, which, you know, might be changing soon. But basically what that's allowed is you get these sort of mega corporations that essentially are in every single different part of healthcare and just it's totally consolidated and powers in the hands of a really small number of players. And they can kind of, you know, have created these pseudo monopolies that do things that kind of look like collusion, but I guess maybe aren't collusion and can price whatever they want because they are the only player in town. And so the antitrust stuff, I think, really needs an overhaul.
Interesting. So on the first one, we're talking about employers and healthcare. So your point is that obviously it's a pain. It's kind of sad that you have to pick jobs and think about healthcare being something that is a major consideration. But you're saying because people change jobs obviously much more frequently than they used to, someone isn't going to be necessarily with the same insurance provider for more, I don't know, let's say on average, let's say it's 3 or 4 years on average, let's say 5 years to make it easy, that the incentives aren't there for them to think about it in a long-term perspective because they're like, hey, like we just extract as much money as we can. We don't have a super long relationship with them. We definitely don't necessarily care how their health is in 20 years, so we're not going to invest in them. Is that kind of the disconnect you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a game of like hot potato, essentially, with the risk of a person, right? Like if you knew you were going to keep someone on your health insurance plan for 20 plus years, you might actually invest pretty seriously in some upstream preventive health stuff to get them to do healthy habits today. But the reality is, if you're going to switch health insurance carriers, no matter what, every 3 to 4 years, what's sort of the incentive there to like get you to do healthy stuff upstream? It doesn't really exist. And in a lot of other countries, you know, employers are involved in healthcare in the form of either paying taxes into pools that kind of like help fund health insurance in those countries, or you know, having defined contributions. So like give specific dollar amounts to health insurers, to people to buy health insurance, et cetera. The thing that's uniquely different in the US is that the employer is actually choosing which plans you get to choose from. And so that is a very different thing, right? Because if I'm a, you know, individual, I now go to a company and they've already predefined the plans that I have to pick from. And I might, you know, I get the illusion of choice of picking between like three plans that they've already pre-selected for me. And we can get into this a little bit later on the podcast, but that is sort of what one of the main tenets of the Affordable Care Act was, hey, what if we set up this individual marketplace where people could buy health insurance similar to the way they just shop around for stuff like e-commerce, and the individual is actually the one going around and buying the plans as opposed to the employer making those choices for you.
Yeah. And one last question on kind of the high level, we'll pretend we're policymakers and actually people will listen in Congress and do something about it, which isn't the case. But, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty of what, you know, the actual, what it looks like on the ground. But last question here, what are your thoughts on a single payer system? And thinking about that, like as someone who's fairly free market economy based, I feel like, you know, it's one thing to like have a free market for flat screen TVs and discretionary goods, I think healthcare becomes, it's, you know, it's not necessarily a discretionary good. Everyone needs it. So on that sense, I can see the appeal there. You talked about kind of some of the monopoly issues. I can see the appeal there potentially. But from an innovation standpoint too, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the US has one of the best countries in the world for bleeding edge treatments and technical, like advanced cutting edge technology and new treatments for diseases. One of the worst countries for access to just basic affordable primary care. So is there a way that, I guess, two-part question, what are your thoughts on a primary care system or a single payer system rather? And if you think it's a good thing, how do you, even if it provides, is there a way to be able to have your cake and eat it too, where you can have access to primary care at a cheaper price across the board with a single payer system, but still remain and retain rather kind of the innovation and the cutting edge stuff that, you know, I think it's probably painful to say, but a lot of that's probably driven by the capitalist, you know, greed, you know, just trying to find that, but that, sad to say, but that probably drives a lot of the innovation. So two-part question there, may I give you a lot of data, but thoughts on that?
Yeah, totally. You're going to get me dragged in the internet for this one. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I'm still sort of formulating thoughts personally on the single payer stuff. I think one thing is that there isn't a totally honest discussion about the ideological trade-offs that happens with a system like this. I think people, you know, just say like, oh, we should ever, like, it's a non-starter that we should just have single payer or Medicare for all or whatever. And I, you know, I think there are very real trade-offs with a system like that. I mean, one that you sort of alluded to is there's going to be less sort of pushes for highly innovative technologies in a system where you get reimbursed less for said breakthroughs. You know, that being said, I think there are ways you can achieve that. I think there are ways to address a lot of these problems. So for one, I think just a bare minimum thing that we should be doing in this country is having a public government run option for things. You know, another uniquely US thing is that we don't have, like, for example, a public health insurance option for the majority of the population. That exists in Medicare, for example, but for the average person, it's like we're choosing between a lot of just different private health insurance plans. But, you know, there definitely should exist, I think, at least a public health insurance option that then forces all those private health insurance plans to kind of have to compete against at least the bare basics plan that you can afford from the government. And you have to combine that, I think, with also a public kind of health system too, like a hospital system, because, you know, you need a government run health system that people can go to as kind of the baseline, which would then make hospitals and providers more competitive with at least the baseline government run system. So the problem is, like, we right now have the worst of both worlds. We have the worst from a regulatory standpoint in that there's so much burden for new competitors to enter the market. And we have the worst of a free market system, which is the extremely consolidated players have essentially become rent extractors with no competition whatsoever. And so I think you can actually achieve a more competitive marketplace by introducing a government-run version of health system and health insurer that at least forces everyone else to shape up. I think, I mean, there are other things that I think would be great. I think having totally covered primary care for everyone would be fantastic. And, you know, again, we sort of have this problem in the US, I would say, of having health insurance trying to sort of treat preventive stuff, elective stuff like surgeries, and then totally unpredictable stuff, so that people do less preventive stuff because, for example, they'll be below their deductible and suddenly they have to pay all that out of pocket. And they're like, well, why should I do all this preventive stuff? It's going to be really expensive. And so we're kind of using really blunt instruments to tackle these problems, and it's just not working. So yeah, I think there are ways to introduce some concept of competition into these areas that we just don't have today.
Give us a sense of where healthcare premiums are right now. And, you know, recording this, you know, April of 2021, for I feel like for 2 or 3 years, it just every year you'd get this letter in the mail and it'd just be like, bam, your health insurance premium is going up, you know, 30%, 25%, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And if you have a family or, you know, you have some health issues, it was getting, I mean, a lot of people were spending more on their healthcare, high deductible healthcare premiums than they were on their mortgage. Is that still the case? I feel like I have heard less of that this last year and a half. Maybe that's just because it's been a lot in the news on a lot of different fronts. Have premiums started to slow down, accelerating, or are we just not paying attention and they're still going up as fast as ever?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in like the 10 years, starting in like 2009 or so, I think premiums grew twice as fast as inflation, somewhere around there. The actually egregious part is how fast deductibles have been rising. So that has been like, you know, it's like 180% plus whatever over that time frame. And, you know, you probably have seen this in your own health insurance of like, now you're paying these high premiums, but on top of that, like it doesn't even kick in until after X thousand dollars later. So it's really a double whammy there. I think in the last year, it's just kind of really complicated. One, because, you know, the health insurance, you know, marketplace has just been totally out of whack because people are losing their jobs, getting their jobs back, getting furloughed, etc. I actually had a reduction in my premium for the first time, I think, ever this last year. So that was pretty crazy.
Wait, is that allowed? I thought that was illegal.
No. I mean, you know, it's like, but there, you know, it's funny you mentioned this, though. There is an actual law. So health insurers can only keep 85% or 80%, depending on what type of plan it is, can only keep 85 to 80% of their premium dollars. They can only keep 15 or 20% of their premium dollars for non-claims related things. So basically, they have to spend 80 to 85% of the premium dollars they collect paying it out on claims for people. And so last year, when no one was getting surgeries and people delayed a lot of medical care, et cetera, the health insurers were left with a huge surplus. And, you know, a lot of them did different things with that money. But, you know, I saw some stuff in the last couple of weeks about how there's probably going to be a ton of rebates that happen to people because health insurers have had just, you know, really low amount of healthcare utilization last year. So, you know, totally possible that you could actually just get money back too.
Right. Let's love to have you put your hat on and imagine you're a small business owner, an e-commerce store owner. Let's say you've got somewhere, you know, in 5 to 20 employees. So you've got a meaningful employee base, but you're not enormous. You're definitely under the cap of the, I think, yeah, what is it? Is it 50? If you have 50 or more employees, you're required to pay for healthcare for all of them. So say you're under that. What are the options for a business to provide healthcare? And maybe we can go through from, you know, most cost-effective. I'm sure there's pros and cons to each of them, but yeah, what are the options, especially with a group plan? Maybe we can start with obviously you can provide a stipend, you can kind of use through HRA, which is health reimbursement account. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah. And so you can tax advantaged account where you can create you don't have to pay tax on it. You just pass along money to your team and they can go buy their own healthcare, which is an option. But if you're doing a group plan, What are the options for that today?
Yeah, I think maybe just taking a step back for 1 second. I think the two things you really have to think about is, one, are my employees kind of all over the place, or are they all in one geography in one area? And then two, do I want to do a system where people pay for their health insurance and I reimburse them? So really putting the onus on your employees to kind of go around and make their own individual decisions, or do I want to be kind of trying to customize a plan that makes most sense for my employee base and put the onus on me/the HR department, et cetera. So those are, I think, really the two junctures that are worth thinking about. You know, if you have a few options, I would say, if you're going down the group insurance route. So the one that I see that's pretty common is using a PEO, which is, man, I should know that's an acronym, but
Employer organization, I believe.
Yes. Okay. That sounds about right. Between the acronyms, you know, I keep getting confused on which one counts as what. PEO, SEO, all that good stuff. But yeah, so PEOs, you can think of them kind of as they're like co-employers of your employees. So they will handle all of the back office stuff, and that you can think of them as kind of being outsourced HR. So everything from handling benefits, handling payroll, all that kind of stuff. And so you're sort of paying for the whole bundle of those services. And one thing PEOs do is they can get better access to negotiated group rates on behalf of all of their clients. So you can, you know, for the health insurance stuff, you can actually get pretty decent rates, even if you're a small business, by pooling together with all the other small businesses that use that PEO. You know, there are pros and cons to this. I think one of the great things is you get access to these rates. The, you know, HR is sort of this outsourced function that can answer all your employees' questions about health insurance enrollment and all that kind of stuff. And then the downside is just you have less flexibility and customizability over the health insurance plan itself. It's kind of like a few set plans that you can choose from. And if you have a lot of employees that are sort of scattered around, you'll also just get like a sort of general national plan, which, you know, it might be, some people might really like, some people might not. So that's kind of one route you can go down. You can also just go down the traditional route of working with a broker who will find a custom solution and plan for your employee and your employee base. But as with anything that you pay a broker for, it's just more expensive for depending on what you're getting. And then the other thing to think about is, you know, to be eligible for a lot of these group plans, you need to have, in some cases, like a minimum number of employees in a given state or in your organization, et cetera. And so you might just not meet minimums for something like that. So I would definitely recommend chatting with brokers about just whether it even makes sense, because most brokers are also, you know, they don't want to work with companies that they don't think would be a good fit for them either, and are pretty upfront about that. So that's one area to look into. I know you had mentioned sort of in the pre-show notes about shop plans, which, you know, shop was, you can think of it as almost like a little mini exchange for small businesses. It's really died down quite a bit. There just wasn't a ton of participation in those plans. So they are pretty scarce to find now. Some states
are these through the government, through the ACA, or not ACA, I guess, but a government kind of either sponsored or subsidized plans, or
so they would be it's almost like a little separate exchange that states would set up, and they would basically give credits to small businesses to get health insurance plans through these exchanges if they met certain criteria. I don't remember it off the top of my head, but I think it's like certain number of employees making less than X amount of dollars per year. So there's some criteria there. But they just weren't super well utilized, frankly. And so some states have really active ones. Most states have actually totally deprecated them. So depending on where you're actually based and incorporated, you can just check if you have a shop exchange in your state and see what's sort of available there. But it sort of didn't take off, I think, the way that it was supposed to. So that's the group side. Then the other side is kind of the more, we're going to put the individual onus on our employees to kind of pick and choose which health insurance plans make most sense for them. And I think that's pretty attractive, especially if you have employees in a lot of different states. And so there are, you know, two kind of types of HRAs. So there's one called a QSE HRA and one called an IC HRA. There are slight differences between them, but the main gist is that you basically give your employees the tax benefit dollars after they buy their plan. So you're kind of reimbursing them. The thing that I think is really cool, the ICHRA is actually very new. And the thing I think is really cool about that is, you know, for it alleviates, I think, a lot of the problems that the QSEHRA had, which is ICHRA can actually grow with your company. So if you do grow above, I think it's 50 employees, you can still keep the same ICHRA kind of arrangement. And also, you know, there are no kind of minimum contribution amounts that you, there are no minimum, sorry, no maximum contribution amounts. So a QSEHRA, there's a total amount you can do the reimbursement for. That's not the case for the ICHRA. So that's, I think, the big difference and something that, you know, a lot of people are sort of exploring. One thing that I'll probably just mention here, because I think it's kind of unique to this year. So on the individual exchange, one thing you have to sort of think about is, does this plan make more financial sense for my employee to get it through me, the employer, who can maybe negotiate better rates on behalf of the group, or from the exchanges where they might get subsidies and credits and all that kind of stuff? So it's a little complicated, right? Because, you know, most employers are not going to know the total household income for their employees, but, you know, they might get a sense based on just their own payroll. But it's worth just like trying to sort of think through that, because right now there's a ton of subsidies for people getting health insurance through the exchanges. So you get a ton of tax credits and subsidies for getting plans if you're at a certain multiple of the federal poverty level. But also even beyond that, they've actually capped the amount that a household can pay on premiums to 8.5% of the total household income. And so that is now, I think, sort of the baseline you're competing against. If you think your plan is going to kind of cost an employee more than 8.5% household income for a given year, it's actually probably more attractive for them to get it through the exchange. This probably doesn't matter a ton if you have like mostly young employees, but, you know, for people who are, you know, 55 plus, those health insurance plans can get really expensive. So the 8.5% cap is actually quite huge there.
Yeah. And if you're using the HRA route, if you're an ECF community member, we've negotiated a special deal with them. I think it's like 3 or 4 months for free. So I'll link up to that in the show notes. That's who I use for our HRA for e-commerce, just for the company. And it's important. Like for a while, I thought you could just, because I think it used to be you used to be able to just reimburse your employees for buying healthcare. But I think legally you have to do it through one of these HRAs, which have kind of checks and balances and making sure, oh, hey, let me see the receipts for your healthcare. It kind of does all the admin for you to keep you compliant so you don't get fined. So wasn't aware of that for a while.
And I believe you get tax benefits going through that route too. It's tax advantage dollars, if I remember correctly. So
yes, yep, definitely. But yeah, I think in the past, I was under the impression you could just do it kind of like, just directly. So, hey, employee sends me their receipt for their healthcare, and I just on my payroll, just like they were submitting an expense report. You know, I could just do, which is tax advantage. But yeah, that's no dice. Apparently,
yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, it was good. So what if somebody is let's say somebody has a 10 people, 10 staff members, and they determine that buying in group is probably the best way to do it. PEO is probably going to be, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, maybe overkill for them. Shop plans don't sound like a great fit. If they don't want to do the HRA and they want to try to do the group plan, do you have much? I mean, 10 people isn't that many people going through an insurance broker. Is that going to be a tough route for businesses that size to try to do a group plan? And I guess what I'm asking is, do you have a sense of where the threshold is if somebody's not doing a PEO, where it makes sense to try to think about trying to talk to brokers and negotiate a group plan and think about all the, all of the headache of, especially with so many remote teams, if they've got employees in 4 or 5 states, which is much more common these days, even for companies who have warehouses, where is that help someone who's listening that has, 25 employees, whatever the number is, decide, should I actually go invest the time to try to see if I can get a group plan out of a PEO or should I just go PEO or HRA route?
Yeah. I mean, frankly, I don't think you have a ton of leverage from an employee size perspective if you have less than 50 employees. But what I will say is, for example, if you have a lot of employees that maybe really care about getting like a certain provider and network, for example, or like they really like care about certain benefits that they have, and maybe that's special to your employee population or whatever. If you want that level of flexibility and customizability, then I definitely think you should talk to a broker about group plans, because they will be able to help you work with the carriers they work with to kind of figure out a plan that makes the most sense for you. So you might not necessarily get like way better prices from a group from just the number of employees you have, but you might be able to actually negotiate different plan designs that might make more sense for your employee population. So if the thing you care most about is price sensitivity, then the PEO HRA route is probably the thing that makes the most sense. But if you care about there's something kind of like specific to your employee population, you want to like customize it to a certain degree, then, going the kind of broker route, I think, is important.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at e-commerce fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners, doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has 3 big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people if you're in e-commerce fuel. Our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with, or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into, avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard, only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7 or 8 figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion. Let's talk a little bit about just if you are buying individual insurance, either you as the, you know, either this is for your employees who are buying it through an HRA or you as an employee of your own business are buying it through that as opposed to the group plans and kind of some of the alternatives as well. Because obviously you can go buy direct from companies. You can go onto the, we already talked about going on to kind of the marketplace and looking for the plans there, either subsidized or not. What are your thoughts on a couple of things? Are there good catastrophic plans? Like I think about a lot of members and entrepreneurs where the only reason they have health insurance is for that fringe case. I get cancer. I don't like the tail events of massive car crash, or my child has some brain, you know, something where it's going to cost hundreds of thousands, if not over 7 figures, right? Like, and if they could have a plan where it was a $50,000 deductible, they felt comfortable being on the risk for that in case something fringe happened. They're comfortable paying for the kind of out-of-pocket needs in full for anything under that. I think for a lot of people, that would be an attractive option from a premium to risk standpoint. You know, if it was, you know, maybe $2,000 or $3,000 a year, but had a big deductible. Are there any good catastrophic plans? What's the law on that? Is that something people can buy?
Yeah. So there is something formally called a catastrophic plan. I'm actually on one of them. It's for people under 30 years old. And it's basically exactly what you said. So I pay about $880 a month in New York, and it's a $8,500 deductible. So really high deductible, really just designed for those tail end events that you're talking about. And, you know, at $185 a month, you know, you can do the math, but paying somewhere around, you know, maybe $3,000 a year, something like that. When you're above 30, you don't qualify for those plans anymore. I think what you're alluding to, so for traditional ACA plans, you know, you're not going to find something that's sort of extreme. I mean, bronze plans, which is sort of the lowest metal tier, is as, you know, as kind of low premium, high deductible as you're probably going to get for that. I think what you're alluding to is there's a lot of kind of non-ACA compliant plans, which are a little bit more catastrophic in nature, whether it's short-term health insurance, you know, health sharing ministries or stuff like that. You know, there's even like sort of supplemental insurance that kind of will that things like Aflac and stuff sort of provide. You know, I think the thing with those plans that's just sort of important to realize, and you know, you should know what you're buying, signing up for, and buying. So it's really just onus is on you to kind of do the research. First of all, there's a super wide variance in those kinds of plans. So really looking at the fine print is important. And some of the things you should just think about are, one, do they not exclude pre-existing conditions? And what do they call a pre-existing condition? So you might not even qualify because they knock you out for some reason. The second thing, which I think really traps a lot of people, is what is the basically like lifetime coverage? And so there are some plans where they'll be like, hey, listen, we only pay up to whatever, like $1 million. So that sounds like a lot of money, but you know, if you go into something crazy, for example, you could go potentially above that, right? Over the course of your life with the insurance plan. And so, and some will have this, but in annual form. So it'll have annual coverage limits. If you go above that, suddenly you're on the hook for the whole thing. And so the thing with like tail end, you know, catastrophes is how much you're going to pay is very varied, right? You could end up with something, you know, if you end up with cancer, God forbid, you will potentially be on a lot of really, really expensive medications and treatments, and you'll go way above that lifetime coverage, for example. So, you know, I would just say do your research and kind of know what you're signing up for. The thing with the ACA compliant plans is they don't have those things. And so at least you know once you hit your out-of-pocket max, you're not going to pay above that.
Yeah, there was, and you alluded to these a little bit, these health sharing groups. I'm going to link up to a blog post by Mr. Money Mustache. We talked about his experience with these and direct primary care and some other things. And our family for a couple of years has been on one of these health sharing groups. It's called Samaritan Ministries. It's got a faith-based one. There's other ones that are just kind of non-faith related. Sedera is one. Kind of the whole point being that, yeah, it's more of a health cost share. It's not classified as insurance. And it won't get too into the weeds here, but it's members reimbursing each other directly for their healthcare expenses. And I found there's definitely some, you have to be really careful and read the fine print, like you said. Like, it's not insurance, so they're not legally required to pay, although it seems like they've had a pretty good track record of it so far, at least the ones that we're using and I've looked at. But there's also some things there's certain things they don't cover. Like, if you go out, for some of them, pre-existing conditions is one issue. Other things are like behavioral. Like, if you go out and get drunk and get in a DUI, they're not going to cover your medical expenses because they feel like that's something that, they kind of have some behavioral issues in there in terms of restrictions. What are your, I think in some senses, in our family's case, it's made a lot of sense in terms of just the cost of benefit analysis after carefully reading the fine print. Do you have thoughts on those? Like, if people understand what they're getting into and that it's not insurance, do you have a thought on if that's a, what are your thoughts? And don't feel bad, back in the bus over me here, given the fact I'm on one, if you're sharing candidly. But yeah, what are your thoughts on those?
I think it's one of those things where there's like a societal optimal and individual optimal thing. So, I think societally it's a little tricky because, again, this kind of allows people who are healthy to kind of skip out on the normal risk pool. And so that makes it more expensive for all the more, sicker people. But, that's sort of like a more structural issue that needs to be addressed by the government. It's not the onus of people to fix that. From an individual standpoint, I think there's some really interesting parts of health sharing ministries, actually. I mean, I actually really like the idea of really turning your health insurance pool into a sort of community. I think that's an underrated aspect. But I do think it's one of those things where it works well when it works well when everything's going well, right? So I can't like definitively say this, but for example, let's just say this year people start now getting all those delayed treatments, etc., that they put off from last year. If everyone suddenly needs to pull money at the same time, what happens, right? These health sharing ministries are not legally required to have enough finances on deck to pay out all that stuff if, something like that happens. And so are people just like left dry? I'm not totally sure, right? I mean, look, we've been in like a bull market for like 12 years. So these companies have not like built I don't know. I don't think a lot of these companies have built a bear case scenario where suddenly everything kind of, goes down the tubes and everyone suddenly, needs money at the same time, et cetera, and they can't pay each other. I'm just not totally sure what happens in a scenario like that. And again, I think it's just like you said, it's a risk reward thing. If you look at how much you'd pay normally for health insurance premiums versus this, and you acknowledge that you're probably going to be on the hook for a lot of money if something really weird happens, then that's just sort of, it is what it is. There are lots of also, I will say, ways to negotiate down healthcare bills and all that kind of stuff. And I think healthcare ministries really put the onus on individuals to do the shopping of healthcare. So to negotiate, to find rates themselves, to negotiate down bills, et cetera. And that I actually think that's a good thing. I think we should be putting a little bit of more onus on individuals to do some price discovery that just doesn't exist with health insurers today.
Oh, pricing in healthcare is so weird. You walk into anything from a dentist to a primary care physician and you ask how much something is going to cost and they look at you like you just asked, to walk into their bedroom and watch them sleep at night. Like it's such a weird thing in the healthcare industry.
They don't even know in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it's true. They have to check with someone, call you back 2 days later if they call you back at all. Thoughts on direct primary care. For those that aren't familiar with it, it's a model where really insurance company is taken out of the equation and you work directly with a doctor you pay the doctor directly. It's not insurance. It's just you're paying the doctor absolutely directly. And I think some doctors like it because there's less overhead. They don't have to deal with insurance companies. It's just there's no intermediary or agenda driven. And it's something we're experimenting with a little bit. Like, for example, this last month, there's a direct primary care physician in our neighborhood, like 5 or 6 blocks away. So I woke up on a Saturday morning, and this was on a Saturday as well. Woke up on a Saturday morning, had coffee, hung out with my kids, hopped on a bike. In 5 minutes, I was at just a residential house. I went inside, and granted, I think most of these probably have like regular offices, but went inside to a doctor and she converted one of her rooms into a little clinic and got a tetanus shot. Granted, I wasn't having, you know, like open heart surgery or anything, but, and paid her, you know, $120 and biked home. And the whole thing took half an hour. You know, anyway, it was interesting. And we're kind of exploring that as an interesting option for kind of basic primary care. Again, not high level stuff, but what are your thoughts on direct primary care with physicians and patients working directly together as opposed to, you know, having an insurance company in the middle?
Yeah. I mean, I've been watching direct primary care for a while and I'm actually really excited about the concept of it. And there's a few reasons for that. One is, you know, in every other primary care arrangement, there's something that happens in the background called steerage. And basically what that means is your health insurance company wants you to go to certain places for follow-up care and a large hospital wants you to go to different places for follow-up care. And the way they've basically realize that they can control that is through the primary care physician. And so, you know, the largest employer of physicians in the US is actually United Health through its Optum program. And so so basically what happens is that a lot of this stuff is influencing the physician's decision that I don't think patients are aware of. And I think direct primary care is one of the few places where it's really a alignment between the physician and the patient in terms of what they think the next steps should be. I kind of think of it as like if you have a doctor in the family sort of thing. Would you probably trust a doctor in your family's suggestions a little bit more? Yeah, maybe. I think you would because they're not doing it for like financially motivated reasons. The second thing I would say that I like about direct primary care, I think there's been this huge push in the last, you know, decade or so to like turn consumers into shoppers. And that was sort of the whole premise behind high deductible plans. It's like, oh, if they haven't hit their deductible, they'll be more price sensitive. So they'll actually shop around. And that didn't happen for a number of reasons. But one big one was that consumers just don't know how to buy healthcare stuff, right? They're not trained in that. I didn't go to med school, right? To the, you know, chagrin of my parents. I can shop for things on certain dimensions, right? Like convenience or price. But having a physician to help this help me at least filter down, like, here are the things that I think you definitely need, et cetera. I like the idea of this kind of like joint physician plus primary care, sorry, joint consumer and primary care shopper together. I think that's a really powerful concept for healthcare. So I actually really like the concept of direct primary care. I'm really interested to see if you can make the economics work so that it's more affordable to everybody rather than just people who can afford the monthly subscription. But I think conceptually, primary care physicians love it because they deal with a smaller number of patients and spend more time with each. You can actually make the economics work if you know, aren't dealing with health insurance at all. So I think there's actually some really interesting stuff there.
Yeah. And just to clarify for folks listening, a lot, I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, you know the space better than I do, obviously, the majority of direct primary care offices work on a subscription basis. So it's like, hey, $200 a month for your family, and then we'll take care that covers most of your basic visits. Maybe you pay a little extra for labs or kind of things, but it's a subscription-based model. Although not all of them, like that doctor I mentioned I went to was just a a la carte pricing. You come in, you pay, and it's, which I think is really nice, although probably harder for the doctors to make work. But there is don't have it in front of me. I'll link up to the site in the show notes where it's a direct primary care kind of search engine, more or less. So you can type in your, you know, where you live, and it will show you all the, or at least a lot of the providers that are offering that in your area. Kind of as we're getting close to wrapping up here, do you see any promising signs for improvement in the future with healthcare in the United States? Like any trends or legislation or is it, Any green shoots of green hope here? That's a weird phrase I came up with. Any promising signs in the healthcare space, or does it just look like it's just going to continue to spiral into more dysfunction?
I mean, let me put it this way: if we don't start like really seriously figuring things out after like a global pandemic just completely rocked our entire, you know, I it's hard to imagine a time where it would ever happen, if not now. So, you know, I feel like it really does have to happen now. I think there are some, you know, sort of promising signs. I think there's a lot of really cool experimentation happening on a state level basis. You know, there are some states that are really exploring the option of doing kind of a single payer-esque system in their own states. I think Biden is very seriously considering this public option as a, you know, as a potential thing to add. So I definitely think there's like isolated pieces of legislation. But I'll say, you know, I really sit at the intersection of tech and healthcare. That's really like my forte. And, you know, I work with a lot of pre-seed and seed stage companies and do some investing in pre-seed and seed stage digital health companies. And the amount of sort of, I would say, just energy coming into digital health right now is kind of off the charts. And I would say combine that with, you know, you have a lot of new entrepreneurs from, I think, non-healthcare spaces now really interested in fixing the problems of healthcare. Combine that with also a lot of freely available capital that's now being deployed in late stage funding rounds to make these digital health companies more seriously competitors to, I would say, traditional healthcare incumbents. And I think you actually have the formation of like an actually very different healthcare system getting built thanks to tech. And some really specific places I think this is happening, which I'm excited about, are I think diagnostics becoming a very, you know, kind of widespread thing thanks to, you know, kind of the proliferation of COVID testing and a lot of that. I think is really going to change how people interact with the healthcare system, where diagnostics become the first touch point rather than you having to go to your physician first and get tests done second. And then the other area, which I'm actually really excited about, is just home healthcare in general. I think one of the one big reason why healthcare is really expensive is, you know, the facilities are just, it's just massive amounts of capital expenditure on facilities and stuff like that. And so, you know, there are way more ways to now deliver care to the home. And I think reimbursement is sort of following that. There's a lot of like technological developments that are happening that make it easier to deliver care in the home. And then frankly, like, it's just a convenience thing, right? I mean, no one wants to go to the doctor. Like, no one ever says that, right? But if we brought healthcare to more places people already are, home being one of them, maybe your employer's office being another, you know, maybe even these, like, they've been sending a lot of like vaccination vans, et cetera, to places. If you bring care to where people are, I think they'll just more likely to engage in the care, right? Just frankly. And I think home is really where I'm seeing a lot of that happening, and actually makes me really excited.
Talk a little bit about outofpocket.health. So that's outofpocket.health, like .health is the kind of the .com, instead of .com is .health. It's the site/newsletter you run about healthcare. Obviously, you know a ton about the space. And the thing I love about it too is it's, if people haven't picked up on your personality, like you're engaging, you're lighthearted, you've got a good sense of humor, and that all flows through. Talk a little bit about what you're doing over at Out of Pocket that mirrors all those things.
So Out of Pocket is basically trying to teach people how the business of healthcare works broadly. And that's through a newsletter I write. That is through some novelty products I've been coming out with. So I have a children's book about clinical trials called If You Give a Mouse Metformin. And I have a card game coming out where you have to avoid medical bankruptcy. So, I mean, I just have like way too much time on my hands. And then I'm also coming out with some courses to teach people like healthcare 101 and all that kind of stuff. But the general sort of theme is I'm trying to use humor to make it more accessible and easy to understand so that even if you're not in healthcare and you're sort of healthcare curious, it should be understandable for you too. And hopefully, you know, kind of funny and entertaining. Trust me, making healthcare funny, like I think that is like Nobel Prize worthy. So I'm waiting for mine, but
I'll write to him. I agree. Like any humor makes everything better. So
yeah, I'm trying to like bring my like true internet degeneracy into this. So it's like when Reddit meets healthcare sort of thing. But yeah, so I try to make healthcare just easier to understand for people.
Oh, love it. Outofpocket.health. Check it out. Subscribe to them. It's a great newsletter, a great website. All right. I think we should cap this off the lightning round if you're up for it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Great. What's your favorite piece of online tech?
Oh my God. I mean, I'm on Reddit all the time. So my default is to say Reddit. But, you know, actually I've been using Peloton, not actually the bike because I'm too broke boy for that, but I've been using the app. And it's fantastic. I got to say, like, I'm wondering if I'm actually going to go to the gym post pandemic. So I'm pretty you know heavy user of it.
I gotta say, I think like I got Annie, my wife. I got her an Apple Watch and an Apple Plus fitness subscription. And before all of you judge me and say I'm a terrible person at something, she was wanting. So she's really in shape and loves working out. And I have been amazed at she's loved it. It's been good because she's roped me into her evening workouts and stuff with it. And for the price and the variety, like not having to think about a workout routine, being able to do it in your living room with zero commute. I'm sure it's different from Peloton, but probably not crazy different. I think, yeah, that's an interesting space. And I think, I don't know, it'd be a, I feel bad for gyms between the pandemic and all the alternatives popping up. It'd be a rough time to be a gym. And I think, yeah, I think there's gonna be a lot of change in the landscape there over the next 5 years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think just the lowered friction of not needing to, like, you know, go walk to the gym, change again, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that is huge. I'm way more likely to work out now.
What's one of the fondest memories from your childhood?
Okay, so I grew up in New York City and went to high school here. And my group of friends and I were chicken and rice aficionados. So we knew all the good chicken and rice spots in the city. And on Mondays, we used to have really long lunch periods. And so we would travel from the Upper East Side to Jackson Heights, which is, like, you know, easily 45 minutes to an hour each way. And we would sing on the train for money, just sort of as a joke, and then eat chicken and rice kind of on a stoop outside some random place in Jackson Heights, and just, like, be just, you know, degenerate high school people, and then rush back to school to quickly get to our next class, just, like, reeking of chicken and rice. So
would you be singing on the train? Like, is that how you paid for the chicken and rice, just for the money?
We would use it to subsidize our chicken and rice payments or get extra sides that we'd share. We used to sing "Ain't Too Proud to Beg." So, you know, the irony is palpable. We'd harmonize everything, you know?
That's amazing. So were you in, like, choir's wrong word. What was that? Obviously, you were a decent enough singer to make money from it.
No. We were terrible, just to be clear. We were really bad, but we were funny. That was the thing that mattered.
That's awesome. What's been one of the most effective, or what has been the most effective marketing strategy for you over at Out of Pocket over the last 6 to 12 months?
I mean, you know, honestly, the real answer to this is just I am my personality online, offline, and on my posts are all the same. So I'm, like, truly a degenerate through and through. And I just try to be, like, as authentic as possible to the whole thing. And there's really nothing more powerful than that, I think. Like, I don't do, like, growth hacky stuff or anything like that. Like, I'm just doing me, and I have been for, like, the last 5 years. They're the sort of obvious common tactics. Like, I mean, every time, like, a meme that I post goes viral, it'll drive some signups, or anytime I, you know, do a white paper with a download, a lot of people will sign up. But frankly, like, I'm just trying to put information out there that I just don't see is out there. I think a lot of people, when they start newsletters, et cetera, they try to, like, have a take on whatever the most common topic of the day is and kind of, like, try to jump in and get some of that traffic. I don't really do that. I just write about whatever I think is interesting / what things that I think are interesting that I don't see a lot written about. So, for example, you know, I wrote, like, a whole thing about how healthcare works in jail. I didn't really know how it worked. I was sort of curious, wrote a whole thing about it. And it did really well because I think a lot of people were just curious about it. It was interesting, and there wasn't really anything else like it. So really just trying to, like, find my own kind of niche and write about that.
And this could take any number of answers, from a medical practice gone horrifically bad to something atrocious an insurance company has done. But what's the most egregious medical mistake or situation you've come across covering the space?
I mean, okay, so one of the most funny rules, I would say, that exist is there's something called the two birthday rule. And so if you and your spouse, for example, have a kid and you both have family coverage from your employers, well, who does the kid fall under, right? And so the way they have devised this rule is that it's whichever parent's birthday comes first in the year, which is just totally random. It makes no sense, right? Like, it's just like, I really want to be a fly on the wall to know who thought of that rule. From a medical side, I would say people would be surprised at how many times surgeons actually end up cutting out the wrong thing when they go in. There are now, like, entire protocols dedicated to make sure that everyone who is in the operating room is on the same page about what's happening, what's being done, et cetera, to make sure that it doesn't happen. I was just chatting with a friend, actually, who is he coaches expert witnesses medical expert witnesses for malpractice trials. And it was just telling me about a case, and it's all public, of someone who the surgeon went in to remove the first rib and then, you know, finished everything and realized they'd removed the clavicle instead. And I'm just like, you know, that's crazy, right? Like, what do you even say to the patient at that point? I don't even know. It's crazy.
I'm sorry. Doesn't start to do it.
I heard one, actually, just totally. I heard another one, which I thought was crazy, which is they mixed up the used and unused colonoscopy equipment, and someone had a bit of a double dip. So, like, horrific stuff like that. I mean, it's, like, totally by accident, obviously, but, you know, people are humans too. Hospitals are fallible systems. Sometimes this stuff happens.
Probably more than you'd want to imagine. And then finally, what was a major seminal moment or period in your life that helped shape you to become who you are today?
Yeah, well, I think maybe the e-commerce people listening to this will probably appreciate the story. But when I was in high school, I used to sell customized sneakers. So that was like my big side hobby. I used to just do it for money. When I sold my first pair of sneakers on forums online, so this was like the Nike SB forum back in the day, I used to, when I got my first sale through the Nike SB forum, it really just like unlocked a lot of stuff in my mind, which, you know, I couldn't really verbalize at the time. But now looking back, it's like, one, I realized like, oh, you could like make money through the internet. You know, that was like actually a really big unlock in my head. I was like, oh, you can like sell people's stuff on the internet. And then the second thing was also like, you can kind of do like, you can do whatever you want as long as you find a way to kind of like be to really like succeed through it and understand what success is. So for me, it was like, I started doing these painting shoes. I had to like learn all this stuff about like cost of inputs and selling and advertising and all that kind of stuff. But once I did it, I was like, oh, like I can do this. So I think for a lot of people, especially if you're thinking about starting a business, for example, there's like a lot of mental barriers around what you think you're allowed to do and not allowed to do, right? It's like, oh, I can't start a business until I like get this skill set, right? It's like, not really. You just sort of do it and figure it out, right? As like a secondary thing. And so that was really helpful when I was doing the shoe stuff. Even though it wasn't like a real business, it was like conceptually a real business to me. And that in my head, I was like, oh yeah, I can like start a business. It's doable.
Well, Nikhil, thank you so much for coming on. This has been fun. Personally, just kind of expanding my knowledge of healthcare, but just kind of hearing your story and you're a fun guy to talk to and banter with. Again, check out outofpocket.health. All the personality and kind of humor you're hearing here is going to come through on that site just as much. So I really appreciate you coming on the show. And yeah, thanks for kind of taking us into the weeds and talking through what you know in the healthcare space. It's a complex one and you make it significantly less painful than most people do. So well done, sir.
Totally. Thanks for having me. And if anyone ever has questions about healthcare, health insurance stuff, you can find me on Twitter at Nikhilinet or hit me up on LinkedIn or I don't know. I mean, I'm not hard to find. I'm like very online.
Yeah. We'll also link up to those two books, the If You Give a Mouse, Metformin, and also the Avoiding Bankruptcy playing card game that's coming out that you've got out. So, which are both hilarious. But yeah, thank you, sir. It was fun chatting.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening. And the fact that you made it to the end of the episode tells me you're probably someone interested in this stuff and might be a really good fit for the e-commerce fuel community. Our community is the world's largest group of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners and offers a value-packed form, dynamic live events, and much more. If that sounds interesting at all, you should learn about membership and how to apply at ecommercefuel.com. Big thank you to our two sponsors. Supercharge your email marketing efforts with Klaviyo, the world's best email and SMS marketing engine at klaviyo.com/ECF. And also one-click upsell from Zipify Apps, where you can rapidly increase your average order value by offering powerful targeted upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Finally, thanks to Sherelle Torrecampo for helping produce the show. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.